Hey everybody, what's up? This is Marcus, and welcome to episode 2 of the Spacewatch Global Podcast. What's up everybody? It's Space Cafe time, your fortnightly podcast about all things space, the space industry, the universe, and of course everything else. I'm Marcus, I'm a filmmaker and science communicator, and as always I'm joined by my wonderful co-host Anna. She represents Spacewatch Global in the Middle East and Asia regions. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Marcus. Thank you so much for the introduction. It's really good to be back here today with you and our guest, Dr. John Sheldon. It's our second edition of Spacewatch Global's biweekly podcast. Dr. John Sheldon is the subject matter expert when it comes to space policy, cybersecurity, cyberspace, and all related topics. So our listeners are really going to find this interesting, this conversation. I'm personally interested in this conversation. There's a lot going on right now in the world of cyber and AI. We're also going to be looking at some interesting tips from NASA to help us get through this lockdown period that we're all going through. Some really, really interesting content today.
Excellent, Anna. So before we cut right to the chase, let's do a little housekeeping to get us going. Some news from the inside. Our series of weekly webinars is in full swing already. Our third Space Cafe web talk will be 33 minutes with Carla Sharp. Check it out at spacewatch.global. Anna, did you get a chance to watch it already?
I did. Tuned in yesterday.
How was it?
It was great. I mean, I've never heard from Carla Sharp. She's from South Africa. She's very clued up in the African space sector. She's been doing it most, if not all, of her life. And it was just really interesting to hear her viewpoint and the perspective of space in Africa or across Africa.
And for all of you space nerds out there, if you can't get enough food for thought, we bring you a daily newsletter. And I repeat that, a daily newsletter. Please subscribe at Spacewatch Global. So without further ado, Anna, are you by any chance a cyber expert? And are you looking for a job?
I would say I'm a cyber fan. I will leave all of that talk to John later on. There's lots going on at the minute. I think we're seeing a lot more, attacks in this sphere. And in this week, what we're going to look at today is, in fact, the UAE Agency for Cybersecurity calling on experts from artificial intelligence around cybersecurity. So that's very interesting.
So it's fair to say that this agency is proactively looking for knowledgeable people in the field, for cyber experts.
Exactly.
Beautiful. So without further ado, please enter John Sheldon, publisher of Spacewatch Global and dedicated expert in the field of cybersecurity.
Thank you, Marcus, and great to be with you guys.
So John, what is this all about? Who exactly is ANISA looking for? What skills do I need to bring and where do I apply?
So the agency put out a call for requests for experts in artificial intelligence and machine learning to be applied to cybersecurity. And what this does is that it helps those trying to defend networks and computers to defend better, basically, against really fast-moving and rapid attacks coming from all kinds of actors, whether it's criminal organizations or state actors such as the North Koreans, as an example, or terrorist groups such as Daesh. By doing this, it ensures that attackers have less of a chance getting through. The problem with cybersecurity is that an attacker can make as many attacks as they like, and they only have to be right once to get through to the network. The challenge for a defender is that they have to be right every single time. And then when you bring in the human factor, which is not a criticism but an observation, humans have to sleep, they have to rest, it's very hard to sustain attention and so on. If you bring in computers such as artificial intelligence and other capabilities, machine learning techniques and so on, you can actually help the human actors by basically raising the bar for attackers to get through. And that's what this agency are looking for.
Just to make sure, John, we're not talking about sci-fi Skynet AI yet, right?
Yeah, we're not talking HAL 9000 from the movie 2001: Space Odyssey. One that would be creepy. Not yet. It would be creepy. I don't know about you guys, but I love that movie, 2001: Space Odyssey. But HAL kind of creeps me out.
I cannot let you do this, Dave.
Correct. And that leaves me lying awake at night wondering where HAL is. No, this is more to do with what they call machine learning, which is basically algorithms that search for patterns in the attacks. And then once those patterns are identified, you can then put your cybersecurity tools to work, and there will be no human intervention in that process.
And John, can I just ask who's leading this effort? Like, who is at the front of this, of the pack, so to speak?
It's very hard to say. There's a lot of marketing blurb out there from a lot of companies. And you've got to separate also between those who are making, if you will, machine learning code and algorithms and computers, and those in the cybersecurity field. Then there'll be some overlap, but what you tend to find is that a lot of the cybersecurity companies, very good ones, will go out to other companies such as maybe IBM or Google or so on, Airbus, and ask them to help them develop machine learning algorithms, and then they'll apply them to the existing cyber tools that these cybersecurity companies have, or they'll even generate new cybersecurity tools out of them.
So, John, who can apply, and what skills do I need to bring to the table?
In terms of who can apply, it's going to be EU citizens. And so if you're a citizen from an EU member state, then you can apply. And they'll be looking for deep expertise. So anybody with a terminal or other kind of credential. So we're talking PhDs, or certainly someone who can demonstrate extensive experience in the field and in the industry. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who can apply. I am pretty sure also there'll be openings for those outside of the EU, such as from the US or India and others as well, but I would recommend that they go to the website and check that.
Thank you, John. Super interesting. Anna, I have a question for you. Ready for something totally unprepared?
Yes, always ready.
Good. Let's do a little mystery chase. And to all you listeners out there, Anna has not been able to prepare for this. So tell me, who wrote the following visionary lines? Uh-huh. Listen carefully. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there, but can you still recall the time we cried? Does it ring a bell?
Can I ask one of my fellow team?
Let me give you a next line, okay?
Because I know that John will know.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay.
Break on through to the other side. Uh-huh. Hey, Anna, am I hearing you typing? Are you Googling?
Sounds like a song.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a song by The Doors.
Yay! Applause. Applause, Anna. You made it. Congratulations, Anna. So, why am I bringing this up? John wrote a beautiful op-ed published on spacewatch.global titled Thinking About the Future and Preparing for the New Normal. And at some point, I guess we will be on the other side of this corona thing. But what will the other side be like? So what do you think, Anna?
Gosh, that's a big question. I think we need to team up and, where our weaknesses lie, find strengths in others and vice versa. This is really a team effort. I think, like we'll get to later in the show about how astronauts get through in their quarantine and their training and living out, miles away from Earth. It's really about, pulling through this together.
John, what do you say? You wrote the piece. What is on the other side?
Are we talking about the other side of the coronavirus pandemic or the other side of the balls of perception?
Let's stick with corona.
Oh, darn it. Okay. So obviously your guess is as good as mine. And I'm very careful in the piece I wrote to say that, the future, we can't predict the future. No one can. And anyone who claims they can are essentially, lying to you. And they obviously have a bridge they have to sell to you as well. But that doesn't mean we can't think about the future. So I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. The the idea that the technologies we're using right now to do this show, to do this podcast, will stay the course after the pandemic. And I think certainly they will have, you know, established themselves as mainstream technologies after this is all done. But I think also we're going to find that people will crave human to human contact, and so there may actually be a dip in their use. Another example would be people are confusing what the new normal should look like with what it'll actually look like, and there's a lot of wishful thinking going on out there as well. So whatever your pet issue is, whether it's a technology trend or a political issue, you know, you may or may not be right in what you believe in, but that doesn't mean it's going to be part of the new normal afterwards. And another example of that would be there's a lot of talk right now that because of what's going on, because we're seeing air pollution clear up quite rapidly in places like Italy and China and everywhere else, that this is a chance to implement some sort of Green New Deal for the new economy that's going to emerge afterwards. And there's certainly cases to be made for that. Alternatively, there's also a case to be made that we're going to have to ramp up the economy across the world very, very quickly. And the quickest way to do that is to exploit fossil fuels. And, you know, policymakers around the world are going to have a big dilemma here, because there's going to be a very human need beyond just public health to get the economy ramped up as quickly as possible because of all the endemic economic issues that are going to come about. So will the conditions be right to implement a Green New Deal, which certainly under a lot of, you know, scenarios could make new jobs? Or is the scenario going to be more appropriate for ramping up the economy using fossil fuels? We don't know. But we can shape how those futures and how those circumstances can come about. And that's really what my article is trying to get to. So we can't think that it's going to be like it was before, because that's not thinking at all. But at the same time, while it's good to try and shape the future the way we'd like it to be, we also have to be aware that just because we want it to be that way doesn't mean it will. We have to watch how all these various trends and how the circumstances we are in are going to interact with each other and converge and create these new, if you will, super trends that will take us in particular directions.
John, what are the odds that everything will just go back to normal, to the pre-corona world?
Zero. And I say that with, if I can be certain about anything, I can be certain about that. It's going to be, as I said, a new normal. It'll be normal, but in a very different way. And we're already seeing the impact on the space and satellite sector of the virus with the crash of OneWeb and the likely crash of Sky and Space Global in Australia. I'm sure there'll be other companies that are at the moment hanging on for dear life. That's not just true of the space and satellite sector. That's true of a lot of other sectors as well. You could argue that the coronavirus pandemic has exposed vulnerable business models and that these companies may or may not have collapsed anyway at some point. But nonetheless, there's going to be a culling, if you pardon the term, given the times we're in, of companies. And so it's going to change the space and satellite industry landscape anyway. But we're also seeing, for example, a lot of trends that were already in play before the pandemic. They're now going to be accelerated because of what's happening with the coronavirus pandemic. And that's also going to have impacts on the space and satellite sector. And I'll give you one example. The geopolitical situation right now between China and the United States, but also between China and other countries who are very displeased at what they believe, you know, is China's secretiveness in terms of covering up the start of the coronavirus pandemic in the city of Wuhan. We're already hearing that President Trump, for example, is defunding the World Health Organization from an American perspective because they essentially, at least according to him, pandered to Chinese political imperatives. But we're also seeing a lot of countries very unhappy with China. And this is only really, you know, added flames to what was already a very tense geopolitical relationship between China and other countries. And this is going to accelerate. And we're going to see that in terms of how it plays out in space. Only last week, for example, President Trump signed an executive order encouraging commercial exploitation of space resources. And in that executive order, you know, his administration have essentially said that the 1979 Moon Agreement is no longer a relevant piece of space law. And in one sense, they're right. Only 18 countries ever signed and ratified that particular agreement. And then they also basically made the case that space is not a global commons, and they're going to encourage an international coalition to come along with them and exploit the resources that are available in space on near-Earth objects like asteroids, the moon, and beyond. China is not really saying anything in public, but you can detect that the wheels in Beijing are turning very rapidly in terms of how they're going to respond to this. And it's very unlikely they're going to respond to it very favorably. We've already seen, for example, Russia treat the executive order from Washington with great caution. So this is already accelerating these things. There's a lot of debate as to why President Trump signed this executive order now, given everything else that's going on. I know the people behind the language in the executive order, the intellectual impetus behind it, they're very serious, good people. But it would not be beyond the realms of unreasonableness to believe that President Trump released it now to distract from his other problems politically. So we're seeing all these things happening. This is just one example, for to point this out. But all these things are happening. They're going to converge. They're going to do surprising things. So whoever tells you they know what it looks like on the other side, they don't. But it would be very reasonable and very sensible to assume that it will not be the same as it was before. And companies need to adapt, and so do governments accordingly.
That's perhaps easier said than done, but seriously, what does that mean for businesses? How can they prepare?
Well, they need to be prepared for essentially a new market landscape on the other end. And it's a landscape that is already changing under our feet as it is. And it's going to be counterintuitive. So, for example, the current crisis puts an emphasis on any technology that encourages connectivity, that allows what we're doing right now to do this to this podcast, that allows the bane of everybody's life right now, the daily Zoom meetings and so on. Yes, that's very important, but we're seeing OneWeb, as I said, OneWeb found it very difficult to get the funding it needed to build more satellites for its mega constellation of low Earth orbiting communication satellites, which would be counterintuitive given everything that's going on. Elon Musk has made it clear that he expects US government funding, essentially a subsidy, to fund his own Starlink mega constellation. And that tells me that not only is it counterintuitive to believe that just because connectivity is in demand, that every connectivity solution is going to get funded, but it also tells me that the business models for these mega constellations was frankly inadequate. There was always something wrong with them. And now they're being exposed because of what's going on economically with the pandemic. So we're already seeing those things happen. They're shifting under our feet. There are some solutions that are going to come through that will be market winners that are not necessarily being recognized as such right now. For example, anything that can turn an existing cell phone into a satellite phone is probably going to be a winner. But anything that requires some sort of fancy, expensive terminal that's very difficult to carry around in your pocket, won't even fit in your pocket, I think they're going to be facing some trouble. Earth observation, for example, is in big demand right now because planners use it not just for public health monitoring, but also for how to get the economy ramped up in each country, all these sort of things. And eventually there will be a peak in that demand for satellite imagery, and then it will slack off again. But the various things are going to basically find that on the other end, the market's going to be very different in terms of where the demand is.
What does this mean for the space industry, John? Can you tell us a bit more about how companies can maybe look to diversify or pivot, transform themselves? What can we see going forward?
Well, it's probably too soon for any individual company to make big changes right now, but certainly company leadership, company executives and founders of startups, for example, should be looking very carefully at where the you know, which direction trends are going. You know, for example, this current crisis is putting a big emphasis on technological connectivity because we're all using Zoom and we're all doing things like podcasts and webinars, and we're watching a lot of Netflix and iTunes and all these sort of things, Apple TV, at least I am anyway. But the so this is putting a big emphasis on connectivity and broadband. And of course, you know, satellite has a big role to play in that. It's not the only player. Obviously, fiber is a big player. But certainly when we come to that last mile between cable and user, satellite plays a big part. But the connectivity trend, if you will tail off at the other end of the pandemic as people seek out more human-to-human contact, you know, as is only natural. And I'm not saying we'll go back to, you know, pointless daily management meetings in offices. God, I hope we don't. But at the same time, we can also see demand tapering off. And if the demand was such that it really is, we would see that companies like OneWeb and Sky and Space Global wouldn't be in the financial trouble that they are right now. So that tells me is that their business models obviously are being exposed to be flawed, and you know, this has only accelerated their demise, which probably would have happened at some point anyway. So for a company,
but ironically, you know, constellations like OneWeb are needed now more than ever.
You would think,
you know, if suddenly we're all online and using satellites and streaming and connectivity, I mean, surely that opens the door for someone to come in and say, thanks very much, I'll take those 60 satellites that are orbiting Earth that you're no longer going to use.
And that may yet still happen. I mean, it'll be interesting to see who buys up the frequency rights, the spectrum rights for the OneWeb satellites. That will give us a clue as to, you know, what that's going to look like.
It's interesting. I came across an article yesterday on a commentator on sports looking at, a known investor in sports turning to esports. So with no longer cricket, rugby, football, golf, NFL, NBA happening, you know, sporting enthusiasts and fans around the world need to look at something, not just highlights from decades ago or months ago. So there's this whole talk around esports and it becoming even more of a trend. But then again, that goes back to connectivity.
It does, and it also means that at last I have a chance to being an international superstar athlete. Watch this space, folks. But the
wait, what's your sport?
I have no idea. But if it means just, you know, using my dexterous thumbs on the console, then I think I have a chance. My physical sporting days are a long time ago. But the but no, in terms of what it means for the space industry in general, is that you know, what's in demand now may not be in demand at the other end. Big players are going to crash out. Small players, that ones that we hadn't really paid much attention to, may actually rise exponentially. Also, the, you know, a lot of business models are predicated on, you know, perception of what the demand is. That demand is likely to change, and so companies and their leaders have to be aware of this and watch it very carefully. Which is not to say that we need to throw out business plans right now, but be prepared to change them and adapt to what that new normal will be.
Speaking of which, if everything is rearranging, what does that mean for telecommunication companies? When mega constellations, for example, are being set up at rapid pace, poised at providing satellite-based internet, so what will that mean for telecommunication companies? Will they need a new business model?
Not necessarily. I mean, Elon Musk said the other month in the Satellite 2020 show, if I remember correctly, that Starlink is there basically to provide support to the existing telecommunication companies like T-Mobile and Vodafone. They're, you know, in the areas where they find it very hard to get to. And so, which basically means rural areas that aren't obviously very profitable for them, or where their coverage is not what it could be. That leads to the question for companies like Starlink and OneWeb and all these other companies that, you know, aim to, you know, bridge this digital divide through satellite internet. Is okay, so we're, you know, pumping billions and billions of dollars into building satellites and these very aggressive launch cadences to get them up there, and still really no real definitive idea of what the user segment looks like in terms of the terminals. And this is going to basically, you know, in the end only provide support for a 3 to 4% market segment that telcos are already covering. I'm not sure where the money is going and what, you know, what the profitability of that is, which is not to say there is not a case for satellite internet. I'm pretty sure there is. I'm just not convinced that those who are building these constellations very aggressively have really got the right end of the stick about where the market is. That's my point. And I think something like this pandemic and the crisis that ensues from it is going to expose any flaws in that thinking very rapidly. And I would suggest that, you know, not that I think SpaceX and so on are going to go under, but the fact that they are demanding US government stimulus money tells me that, you know, there isn't as much confidence in their business model as they're letting on.
Next up, a fun topic, especially useful during these days of corona-induced confinement. John, I hope you can stick a little longer with us. Anna and John, so what's your EB rating? And don't worry if you have no clue what I'm talking about.
I was going to say that's a very personal question, actually, Mark.
Before it gets too personal, let me solve that mystery. NASA does show quite a bit of humor these days, as they just published tips for living in space or anywhere, especially when it comes to small places. And NASA argues that 20 years of successfully living on the ISS and more than 50 years of flying in space does not happen by accident. So what can we learn from NASA? So here's what they did. They narrowed their learnings from history down to 5 essential skills, necessary not to end up like Jack Nicholson in Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Anna and John, how comfortable are you guys in small places?
Got no choice.
Well, also, and Anna and I are British by, you know, obviously, you know, we were raised, and so we... as an island nation, we're used to living in very small houses and in small rooms and so on. So, which is why, of course, many of us leave the UK to get away from that.
Hang on, I left the UK when I was 14 right. to somewhere even smaller, Singapore.
There you go.
So let's do this, guys. Let's get ready. Let's see if you have the necessary NASA requirements to survive an upcoming space mission. Skill number one, communication. And this is how NASA defines it. Communication means to talk so you are clearly understood. How does that apply to you guys? Okay, next question.
Silence.
I was actually waiting for Anna to talk, so I was trying to be a gentleman.
But that would already have nicely...
I didn't communicate that clearly.
That would have nicely answered my next question, to listen and question to understand. But let's get back to the beginning. Are you able to communicate in a way that you are clearly understood?
Well, yeah, people who know me will obviously laugh their heads off or punch me the next time they see me when they hear my answer. I like to think that I'm a good communicator, but I think evidence from the real world. Well, yeah, but evidence from the real world may dictate otherwise, and
that's why you're on the show.
We're good communicators, but probably in practice aren't as good as we think we are, and I'm sure that certainly applies to me.
Anna, how about you?
On a scale of 1 to 5, a good communicator, probably say 3.5. Room for improvement.
Good. Let's keep John. Let's keep Anna on the team. Okay. Still on the team. Good.
Still on the team. Barely.
Good.
Okay, hanging on.
Skill number 2 out of 5. Skill number 2: leadership, followership. Definition: how well a team adapts to change situations. A leader enhances the group's ability to execute its purpose through positive influence. How does that apply to you, John?
I'm pretty sure my colleagues will roll their eyes and say, yeah, John's not that great a team player. I'm the one, when everyone says we're all on the bus to Abilene, which is an American saying because there's nothing in Abilene, Texas, but we're all on the bus anyway. I'm the one who will be saying, why are we going to Abilene? And everyone else will be saying, just shut up, Sheldon. We're going to Abilene. And so, but I think in practice, and I think when the chips are down, and this is a situation where the chips are down, I like to think I have some leadership qualities, but also know when to shut up and you know, follow what seems to be the best solution, even if it, you know, doesn't necessarily emanate from my own head.
Anna, how about you?
Yeah, so on leadership, on skill number two, leadership followership, I like the description around establishing an environment of trust. So whether you're a leader or whether you're, you know, following a leader, this element of trust is crucial. And I like to think that the people I'm working with, whether I'm the leader in that situation or following a good leader, I like to say that's the baseline.
Thank you. So NASA survival skill number three, self-care. Mm-hmm. Definition: self-care means keeping track of how healthy you are on psychological and physical levels. It includes hygiene, managing your time and your stuff, getting sleep, and maintaining your mood. John, your turn.
Oh, well, I certainly get enough sleep these days with the pandemic and working from home. And I shower every day, even under these circumstances, even if my general office attire these days is shorts, t-shirt and flip-flops. I probably should exercise more given my age and my cholesterol as well. So I probably give myself, you know, using Anna's rating of 1 to 5, I would say I'm a 2 out of 5. I probably will not make the cut for the next launch.
What a beautiful therapy session we're having.
Yeah, this is very cathartic, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, we're upgrading skill number three.
Yeah.
Anna, go ahead.
I like to daily exercise. I mean, here it's supposed to be once a day. I would say I was a 4.5.
All right. I totally believe that you guys are still on the team, and NASA would totally love to have you on one of its upcoming missions. So, skill number four, team care. Definition: team care is how healthy the group is on psychological, physical, and logistical levels. Recognize that this can be influenced by stress, fatigue, sickness, supplies, resources, workload, etc. How about you, John?
That's an interesting question. In this household, we saw the crisis, the pandemic, coming some time ago. And so we're well stocked up on all the essentials in terms of food, medicine, masks, surgical gloves, pet food, all these sort of things. So I guess in that sense, our morale has been boosted by the fact that we are at least saw this coming and took the steps to prepare for it. And no, we didn't take every piece of toilet paper on the supermarket shelf.
1 to 5?
I'd say we are a good 4, just because I want to be humble.
Good. Anna?
Yeah, I mean, just I would just second what John's just described. It's critical, and I think now more than ever.
One more to go. Skill number 5, group living. Definition: group living skills are how people cooperate and become a team to achieve a goal. Identify and manage mm-hmm. different opinions, cultures, perceptions, skills, and mm-hmm. personalities. Demonstrate resilience in the face of difficulty. It's interesting to see all this in the face of COVID-19 at the moment. John, what do you think? How resilient are you?
Well, I've always had a bit of a joke for the past few weeks, which basically says, so you're asking me to stay indoors, read books, do some writing. This is my natural state of affairs as an introvert. So I'm okay with this, although I'm not sure I could handle 18 months of this, as some people are suggesting. This I put into the self-care aspect, by the way. Yeah, self-care is meaningless if you're not caring about the others around you.
Anna, your turn. Are you good when it comes to group life?
Mm-hmm. I think it would be a lot easier, given the circumstances, to live or be around people where you have this common objective. So like the ISS, you know, you've got astronauts up to 6 at any one time living and working together. So there's a common objective. I think the challenge here is you've got, you know, a household with kids, you know, what sort of husband, wife, whatever the relationship is, you know, others around you, And I think it's a lot more difficult to hone in on what the common objective is, you know, day to day, because we're all doing different tasks. So I think if we can maybe try and think and act like astronauts, where we can find the common tasks to do and the common space that we all need throughout the day to do our own respective jobs or tasks, I think that would lead to better success.
All right, guys, I just got a message from NASA and they want you in for one of their upcoming missions because you passed the test. You have all the proper requirements.
Right. Ready.
I don't think they have a spacesuit big enough.
Yeah, they do.
So to all our listeners out there, if you're now keen on joining Anna and John on one of their upcoming space missions, please first go to spacewatch.global and make sure you read the NASA tips, the 5 skills about life in space or anywhere. So we're almost at the end of our show, but to be super honest, I forgot to ask you, John, a question where we were talking about mega constellations, and I'm totally taking advantage of you being here. So please do excuse that we now jump back to an earlier topic we were talking about. But I think it's important and worth revisiting. When you talked about mega constellations, you mentioned that space is becoming increasingly crowded and all that produces friction. So my question would be, who is making the rules in space?
Well, in principle, it should be the people who use space that make the rules for space. And in one sense, they do, in that the body of space law we collectively have has been made historically by those who use it. Now, we can debate until the end of time whether the body of space law is adequate or enough to govern and regulate what happens in space, because obviously a lot of people feel that it does not. But that's a separate issue. And I think this gets to a major fundamental aspect of international politics, whether it's on Earth or in space, especially when we talk about international organizations like the United Nations, which is when people ask, well, the UN should do more, the UN should do X or Y or Z. The UN only does what its member states want it to do. And so when people, criticize the UN for not doing enough, it's because its member states don't want it to do enough. And of course, the opposite would be true if, not that I've heard this criticism recently, of course, but if people would accuse the UN of doing too much, well, that means that its member states are doing too much. And so you get my point here. And so in the end, is there enough consensus if people identify areas of space governance, which is an extension of space law, that is inadequate? Is there consensus then among the users to make the necessary changes? And I would argue right now, rightly or wrongly, there is no consensus.
Say, John, are any kind of comparisons with the Cold War era, when space was a very friction-packed place, valid?
I think on one level it's a fair comparison, in that a number of the, space weapons programs, to you, for lack of a better term, that a lot of people are talking about today in places like China, Russia, the United States, and several other countries, are pretty much in type the same kind of space weapons programs that the United States and the Soviet Union were developing and testing during the height of the Cold War in the 1970s and 1980s. So in that sense, there is a big similarity. Also, and it amazes me all the time as to how short a historical memory we tend to have as a species. There's a lot of commentators right now talking about the current space security environment as if this has never, ever, ever happened before. And, if you're someone like me or you, Marcus, and I'm not casting any aspersions on your age here, but those of us who are old enough to remember the Cold War will remember also that there were, a great deal many tensions in space at the time as well. So there are some similarities. Now, obviously, there are big differences as well. Back in the Cold War, it was two main protagonists, the United States and the Soviet Union. Now it's, a multipolar array of actors, including non-state actors, I should add. involved in the space security mix. So it's, and also there are countries who at one moment will ally with a particular set of powers and then another moment ally with another set of powers. So we didn't see that kind of alliance flexibility during the Cold War. So I would say actually today the situation is probably more complex, even though I would argue that during the Cold War it was arguably potentially more deadly, given that we all were existing under the nuclear sword of Damocles at the time, which brought about those of us again who were raised in Europe at that time and remember it, there was a real sense of existential angst, which I think people are only beginning to feel again in this very day and age with the coronavirus. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, John. What a beautiful moment to end the show on, a beautiful and happy note, like the Damocles sword of nuclear war and COVID-19.
Well, I thought I would end it on a cheery note, and I would also add that we all know a lot now about coronavirus and COVID-19, and I'd like to offer a refreshing alternative, which is basically
wonderful. Space. What a happy note.
At least we know what's coming.
Before we come to the end of the show, let's do a little Space Expresso, a quick roundup of short space news bits. John, Anna, what are your favorite space news bits from this week?
Okay, so Marcus, the I wouldn't say the stories I have enjoyed in the sense that they brought me joy, but the stories I found most interesting have been the release of the Secure World Foundation's Global Counterspace Capabilities Report, as well as also the Space Threats Assessment that was produced by the U.S. think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Security, and the CSIS. These two reports, they use open sources, and they give a very a comprehensive picture of what's going on around the world in terms of military space activities from various countries. And they paint a pretty grim picture in terms of the geopolitical tensions going on. So that's been pretty interesting, and there's a lot of stories coming out of that. In fact, the Secure World Foundation are claiming that the Chinese People's Liberation Army have an operational direct ascent anti-satellite weapon, which was a bit of a bombshell. The other stories that are capturing my attention are NASA and the U.S. Air Force are handing out now a lot of contracts to private companies for landing payloads on the moon in the next year or two, but also for essentially providing intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities in silunar space. In other words, the area of space beyond geostationary orbit up to and including moon orbit. And I think this is part and parcel of the Artemis program that NASA, of course, are putting forward to put human beings back on the moon, but also establish, a permanent presence there. And I think there's a real geopolitical aspect to this, in terms of who gets there first and where on the moon matters as well. In other words, the poles, where they think a lot of the frozen water is. We're seeing now perhaps the beginning of great power competition beyond the Earth orbit belts.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So I think, like I said last week, what I'm really enjoying reading about is how space technologies and applications are used to combat the coronavirus, or to help in whatever shape or form. And we've seen sort of assembly lines and manufacturing capabilities for the likes of Virgin Orbit and others producing ventilators and masks and things. And honestly speaking, that type of shift into this direction is something that we need to see more of. I think that, like we said throughout the show, companies really do need to adjust and revisit their business models. And who knows, Virgin Orbit may be the next, health tech. We just don't know, alongside the various other technologies that they're producing or using for space launch. We've seen a recent example of the NHS in the UK receiving support from the UK Space Agency, again, through different space technologies. And I think the more we see this, the more the general public will realise the role that space plays, the active role that space plays beyond the space sector. And it's a bit of an echo chamber. The industry knows what it does, but the general public, the wider public, doesn't know as much. And it's just interesting to see more and more activities like this.
Thank you, Anna. And thank you, everybody, for sticking with us. We hope you liked the show. And this was the second edition of your fortnightly Space Cafe podcast. We will be back soon. Thanks for listening. For more information, please go to spacewatch.global. And by the way, if you're still confined due to the virus, looking at the stars is always safe and legal. Take care. Until next time.